The Fan on Demand.
It's Wednesday, the 16th of April, 2014. It's Primetime Sports on radio only today. Some compelling programming on television, probably. But I'm not watching. And if you're listening, you ain't watching either. We apologize. It's McCowan is Brunt in the Toronto studios. It's still Canada's most listened to sports talk presentation. Paul Maurice, Winnipeg Jets head coach, will join us in just a little bit. That piece of music from Queen, by the way. Don't Stop Me Now, for Al and Marnie in Niagara. Thank you very much. Brunt, this is right up your alley.
Yeah, it's a great piece.
The story is pretty much as follows. We're going to let our guests tell most of it, but there's been documentation of fights being fixed in the past.
Yeah.
There's been lots of rumor and speculation, continues to be, about the fixing of sporting events. We've heard a lot about soccer the last little while, but boxing has never been immune from speculation. Rarely, however, do you get documentation or somebody acknowledge that they were involved in fixing a fight.
Well, it's kind of talking about the art of it, I think, because this is a certain kind of, this isn't Jake LaMotta throwing a fight in order to get a title shot. This is more on the fringes of the sport of boxing, where anybody who watches the sport understands that a lot of outcomes are preordained. You know, you're not surprised when some guy beats a tomato can, but there's a way of doing it. And that's the great part about this story, which is on Deadspin, by the way, if anybody wants to read it. It's just that it kind of pulls back the curtain on how that's done.
Charles Farrell is a former boxing promoter. He's been involved with some significant boxing people. He is not some guy who has managed, promoted fights in back rooms in front of 50 people where this kind of thing might take place. He's done some pretty high-profile things, and he joins us on the telephone. Hello, Charles.
How are you, Bob?
I'm well. Good of you to take time for us tonight.
My pleasure.
You fixed fights, essentially?
Well, no, I wouldn't say essentially, but it's
fundamentally.
It was part of what I did.
Charles, you're in there. You were a promoter, right? And you were in that part of the business. I've written about boxing a lot and been around boxing a lot, and a lot of people come up to me and say, you know, our fight's fixed. And I always, you know, this my standard answer would be, you know, you really don't have to fix a fight, because if you put a guy in with a guy with someone who knows his job is to lose, you don't have to tell him. You know, if you hire Bruce the Mouse Strauss, who, mm-hmm. a pal of mine, one of the greatest, you know, loser in boxing history, you know that,
right.
Bruce knows what the job is, right? He knows what he's going to do, and most guys do. But, you know, is there a little more to it than that sometimes? You know, before we get into some of the specifics, because some of these anecdotes in this story are fantastic.
Yes, I would say there's a little bit more to it than that. I think that you're right. There are designated losers, and Mouse is one of the great designated losers, and a very interesting loser.
He is that, all of those things, yeah.
Right. I mean, as you know, he actually left his career with a winning record, which is pretty interesting.
It is, but, you know, yes, because he beat, yeah. Well, anyway, there are a lot of fights in Omaha.
Right.
He fought frequently in Omaha, I believe.
How many times did he beat Howard Stern? I think there is more specificity than people think. I mean, yes, of course, what you do, primarily what you're talking about, is intelligent matchmaking. So although nothing is said and there is no per se fix, the mismatch is so flagrant that it takes a rare occurrence for something to go wrong. But I mean, as the article would suggest, I've done that too. I've been on the wrong end of, you know, making mismatches where I didn't go to great lengths to tell the loser to lose, and the loser didn't always lose.
Yes, yeah, and I've seen fights where the loser didn't play by the script, or where the featured attraction was just so bad that it was almost impossible to lose to him. You know, that a guy was so out of shape or so disinterested in the fight that it was hard for the loser to do his job. He couldn't find us. Finding a soft place to land was harder than it might otherwise be. But, there's some pretty well-known people in this story. You know, Mitch Blood Green's in there, and Leon Spinks,
Very late Leon Spinks, right.
But, you know, the one I'm really, because I was at this fight, the Peter McNeely-Mike Tyson fight, the Mike Tyson comeback fight against Peter McNeely, which ended rather abruptly. Tell that story and about McNeely's guy. It's Vinny Vecchione, right? Who was his manager, I guess, at the time, or trainer. I forget which way he was. He was definitely in the corner that night. What's the story there?
This is his manager.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, Vin Vecchione was a very, very good fight manager in the sense that he understood how to move a fighter intelligently, get him a good record without spending a whole lot of money to do it. And that's a very tricky action, you know, to not spend money and do it. But he did it very well. And Vin and I were both friends with Al Braverman, who was Don King's director of boxing.
Yeah, Chuck Wepner's former manager, one of the great characters in boxing history.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And a really smart boxing guy. And so what wound up happening is that they, in essence, what needed to be done is they needed a good opponent for Mike Tyson's comeback fight, since it was clearly going to be the biggest fight in ring history at that point. But Tyson himself was an unknown commodity. He was coming out of prison. He was out of shape. He had, you know, clearly diminished before going into prison. So they had to be careful. So McNeely was a really good choice. But nobody told Vin that Peter was supposed to lose that fight. It was assumed that he would lose it on the relative merits of both fighters.
Yeah.
So in that sense, there was nothing fixed about the fight. But there was an opportunity to make a lot of money. And that's, you know, Vin had essentially arranged all of McNeely's career for a payoff, one big, big payoff. And what he wound up doing is maximizing the payoff by finding a way, or having someone find a way, to bet an extraordinary amount of money that the fight would not go 90 full seconds.
And so at the 89-second mark in that fight, what happened?
At the 89-second mark, after McNeely had been down and was back up and, you know, had been rocked but was clearly in control of his senses and of his faculties in a fight where there was a lot riding on it and a tremendous world interest, Vecchione simply stepped through the ropes, forcing a disqualification.
In under 90 seconds.
Yes.
So how much money was how much was the bet?
I'm told it was $1 million. I believe that.
Wow.
See that?
And I, you know, what's interesting, of course, about the bet, and this is what I don't know, and I don't think anyone will ever know except for the people who won it. It's what the odds were. You know, it wasn't an even money fight.
Yeah. No. And it's, you know, something that specific. You know, over under 90 seconds in a you know, not a title fight, but a big fight. I would think you'd get a pretty good line on that.
I would think so.
Man. Is it, you know, Charles, most of this stuff, again, kind of, you know, that's not a fringe fight. That was one of, as you say, at that point was one of the biggest sporting events in history because of Tyson. Right. And obviously there's an unbelievably bright spotlight. And a lot of people, when the fight ended, kind of went, you know, there was a sense that maybe something was up there. Although no one thought Peter McNeely, everybody thought he was a stiff anyway, so it didn't really matter. But do you think... Or do you have an experience that, you know, in fights that are supposed to be competitive, you know, where there's supposed to be two guys who have a chance to win, are fights fixed in those circumstances or not?
Well, I mean, I think I'd need to ask, certainly, do you mean fights that have a general kind of public interest where there is no clear-cut favorite?
Yeah, where there's not a house guy and a bum, or not a guy whose record is being built, or not a name guy who is being protected, which is, sure, you know, all of those kind of standard circumstances in boxing.
Absolutely. Absolutely there are. Yes.
So how does that happen? Like, I'm not trying to, again, the LaMotta one's the famous one historically, you know, documented in his book and in the film and everything else, but how do you convince a guy who has something in it, you know, we're winning, there's a lot in it for him to win. Yeah, to lose.
There are a number of ways to do it, but I would say probably the easiest way to do it is you find somebody who's got problems that maybe aren't public knowledge, and you basically convey to him the idea that the amount of money he can make by losing and by betting almost always factors into this sort of thing, is so much better than what he would get by fighting competitively and maybe losing, and even if he were to fight competitively and win. And there are any number of instances where that's occurred. Certainly has occurred in the heavyweight championship fights.
What would be a big fight that people would remember that you either strongly suspect or know was fixed?
I'll say one that I do not know was fixed, but I would strongly suspect was fixed. Would have been the first Manny Pacquiao Timothy Bradley fight, which. Although the fight itself was legitimate, it was a real fight, I'm absolutely certain that people knew what the outcome of that was going to be beforehand, including one of the participants.
Okay, so that would be one. So that would have been fixed through terrible judging, you know, or by owning judges one way or another, because that went to the scorecards, and so it was right. Somebody taking a dive. Obviously, Pacquiao just avenged that loss last weekend, so it's in right. the news as well. Let me interject there.
Do you believe that fight was influenced by people who went to the judges?
Yes, I do. I mean, did you? Presumably, of course, you both saw the fight.
I did for sure. Yeah, and it was
What did you score it?
8-4, something like that. You know,
yeah.
For Pacquiao.
I mean, but there was no question as to who won that fight.
No. There was absolutely no question. And I don't think anybody on earth. Thought that the outcome would go that way. No one did, except although you're saying that somebody maybe knew it was going to go that way.
Odds were 6-1. So there was enough money to be made betting it, and there were reasons to bet it. So that I'm absolutely certain that fight was not a legitimate fight.
Even though, you know, Pacquiao's an incredibly valuable guy, you know, as the most valuable commodity in boxing at that moment, and it diminishes him to lose the fight, so... You know, a guy like Bob Arum, it's not a good night for him.
Maybe. I'll say maybe. Right. I think the thing you have to ask yourself is, does it diminish him? He loses a decision on the judges' scorecards, but he doesn't lose that fight anywhere else on earth. Nobody thinks of him as a loser. They think of him as a cheated winner. It did very, very little to deplete him in terms of the public eye.
Yeah, no, there's a point there
Do you have any idea what it would cost to buy a judge in a high-profile fight like that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, what's the number?
Far less than you would think. Let me modify that. Let me say something else. There are two ways to buy judges. And it's not necessarily a straightforward situation. A lot of it has to do with a recurring work situation that takes place over years and years and years. Now, you see that in referees, you know, and that's where it's more, of course, much more evident. You see certain referees who do things that are very questionable, and they get really good work.
Mm-hmm.
So... You know, I think you can't talk about a dollar amount necessarily on a per-fight basis, although these fighters, judges who rig scorecards are certainly paid. But you also have to look at judges who come in who are essentially ringers. They come in from out of nowhere in strange fights, and, you know, major fights. They come in from out of town, and they're the dissenting view.
Yeah.
And people say, well, where did this person come from? They were flown in. You see that. I mean, I'll tell you something. When Floyd Mayweather fought Saul Alvarez Canelo,
mm-hmm.
I told people beforehand, it's not going to be a unanimous decision. It's going to be a completely one-sided fight, but you're going to get one judge who no one has ever heard of. And if that judge can at all make a case for Alvarez, that's what that judge will do. If not, it's going to be a majority decision, which is what it was.
So what's the, and that is, so, but what,
what's the upside
yeah, who's,
to
yeah,
that?
Who's what's
the upside
that,
yeah, what, what's the upside in buying one judge and not getting
upside,
the verdict?
Okay, the upside, there are two upsides. One is that if the fight is at all close, they can give it to Alvarez, which in terms of business helps a lot more people than if Mayweather makes a lot of money for himself. He doesn't necessarily make a lot of money for anyone else. And Alvarez was on the verge of being a kind of media pop star. So, and he's a young man. Those things all factor in. The other thing is that if you take into account that he's a guy who's a media pop star and has a long career ahead of him, there's a narrative spin that you can then put on his losing a majority decision to somebody like Floyd Mayweather, you know, the, putatively the greatest fighter in the world, where he's done himself no great harm. The storyline goes, I just lost a majority decision to the best fighter in the world, and I'm still a young man, I'm learning. And his marketability is barely touched.
Yeah, that's
so. They're good business decisions for doing that.
It's a fascinating story. It's on Deadspin.
Deadspin.com. Great, a great read. If and there's some amusing stuff in there as well. There's a great Leon Spinks story, and yeah, I highly recommend it.
Turn it into a book. You'll sell millions.
I'm doing that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I look forward to the book.
Thank you, Charles, for taking time for us tonight. We appreciate it.
Thank you for calling. It was a lot of fun.
Charles Farrell, former boxing promoter. How to fix a fight.
Well, and it's, you know, Bob is, you know,
more than one way.
Well, and it's not often you get somebody who works inside a business. You know, we had Declan Hill talk about fixing soccer, and but he's an outsider. To have somebody who's in the business saying, yeah, I did this, and this is how I did it. And by the way, you know, these fights were fixed, and this is how you do it, and this is who you pay off. You know, it's kind of a, you know, boxing's got a bad reputation, maybe legitimately, but there haven't been many guys from the inside come out and rat people out and say, this is what we've been doing all these years, by the way.
Yeah.
So that's pretty extraordinary, actually.
Paul Maurice, the head coach of the Winnipeg Jets, took over in mid-season, almost, well, not quite exactly mid-season, a little past the midway point, and got the Jets to play very good hockey right away. And when all was said and done at the end of the season, 18-12-5, if my numbers are correct, was the record of the team after Coach Maurice took over. He was rewarded with a 4-year contract extension, so he'll be in Winnipeg for a while. Here's Paul Maurice. Well, congratulations on a pretty impressive end of the season and a very nice contract extension.
Yeah, thanks very much, Bob. Thanks to you. I appreciate that.
I alluded to the fact that you were able to turn this thing around very quickly, instantaneously, with the Winnipeg Jets for a period of time. As you look back on it, what made that happen?
Oh, I think sometimes in the Canadian market it can be pretty tough, and they were feeling both barrels of it. You know, things weren't going well, and it's easy for a new guy sometimes to walk in the room and say, look, we're going to do these two or three things, but they're hard things to do, and you may not enjoy doing them, but you're going to do them. And they off they go, and you know, we were instantly kind of a better defensive team, and we were healthy at the time, and we started winning good. And then there's the slingshot there, because the pressure not only comes off, it's now in the other direction. There's enthusiasm, there's life, so we got rolling pretty good there. But when that coaching change comes, that's the you get the players the most eager to just get out of what was a tough situation, regardless of who's behind the bench. When you get into that kind of free for all, and you know it's coming, you're willing to do anything to get out of it. So playing a little better defensively was what we asked them to do, and we had maybe more success than would be natural for a team in our situation. But a big part of that was just we played on some pretty strong emotion after that.
Is that because you're telling them something different than the last guy did, or because it's coming from a different guy?
So both, you know, like, and I've been in the exact same situation the Claude was. When you start coaching per game, you know, it's that survival mode. You end up overlooking. You get to a point as a coach where there's no such thing as short-term losses for long-term gains. That short-term loss might be your job. So you're going to sweep some things under the rug, and you're going to focus on maybe one or two things that you think you're good at, and out you go, and your fingers are crossed. And then the new guy comes in and says, look at these two, three things are obviously broken, and we're fixing them regardless of what happens in the score tonight or in the next 2 weeks. And lo and behold, usually when you take care of your process, you start winning a few more games, and you're feeling pretty good. A lot of it's just the situation that the players and coaches get themselves into time after they haven't had success for a while.
With Paul Maurice, so I'm intrigued by this. You walk in the room and you give him the speech, and you said, here's the things you're going to do. And a whole bunch of guys clearly buy in because the team responded.
Right.
Could you identify guys that didn't buy in? And how does that affect your long-term judgment of the character of those guys? I'm not asking you to name names, but...
No. So there'll be a handful of guys that are going to go, yeah, that's really not what I do for a living. I'm going to try.
Right.
So they're going to try, and they're going to... And then, when, especially when you're having success, there'll be the guys that are flourishing, and they're going, oh, thank God, we're back to playing the game the way it's supposed to be played, in their minds. And then there's a bunch of other guys go, huh, new guys coming in. We're winning a few games. That's really not for me. You know, this whole physical conditioning thing that he's talking about, I'm not really interested in it. They start looking for another place to play in their own minds, you know. So they survive it if they can, and then off they go.
Can you identify those guys?
Yeah, pretty quickly.
Real quick, huh?
Not, you know what? So there's the short-term guy, and he's the guy that when he's in the marathon after the fifth mile, he goes, yeah, you know what? I don't feel it today. There's no sense me running 22 miles to see if I can finish. I'm not finishing. I'm done. So they, you know, listen, they keep showing up. They keep doing their things. But you can see it on the ice in terms of how many times you kind of have to reinforce what you're saying to them. You know, look, I know you're a smart guy, but this is now the fourth time I've told you I wanted to stop here and put your stick on the ice. So those guys, and what happens is their minutes also get cut back. And then there's, God bless the guys that are going to try. They know it's not, and they're going to try, but at the 21st mile of that marathon, it's over. You know, so they give you what they have. They couldn't do it. You're almost not angry at those guys. It's just, you know, there's another place for you. It's just not here right now.
So things went pretty well. I mean, you were above 500 in your tenure of 35 games. But you got off to that quick start, and I forget. Did you win six in a row, seven in a row, something?
Yeah, four, actually. But then,
four, okay.
8-2.
Right.
So we ended up, after the break, being eight games over 500, at the break, six games over 500, and that's where we ended up. So after the break, we played 500 hockey.
So how do you evaluate players as you sit down with your exit discussions and as you start to move forward into your first full year with this organization? And how much of it is based on what you saw from those guys in the first, you know, 10 games where things were going great, and then when things settled back to not being bad, but
right,
not being quite as good?
The veteran guys, I'm almost only assessing what they did when things went bad. So the last three or four games of the season, we had 9, 10, and 11 guys out of our lineups. We got beat up real bad in there.
Yeah.
So it was kind of good. Even if you're... if you plan on changing a lot of things, you know that 80% of those contracts in your room, that's your team, right? You can move a guy or two, but you can almost never assess those fourth and fifth line guys, and we had a whole lot of them play. So we got a way better feeling for the bottom part of that team. And then there's a bunch of leaders that we kind of really challenged down that stretch. And when I say that, I mean got into them a little bit about this is the time for you to do this now, and they all did it. You know, we had a tough trip. We lost in L.A., and we played terrible in the first period, and then we thought we fixed it the next night and had a phenomenal start in Anaheim and lost, gave up four goals, lost in overtime, and then went back-to-back nights into Phoenix. So prior to my being there, they hadn't won a game back-to-back nights. So those were the things we started saying, you have to win this game tonight at all costs. We win this game tonight, and they were able to do it. You know, it was ugly. The last two games of the season, so we played on Thursday, Friday. Well, Wednesday's practice was an hour and a half long, and it would have been, for some of them, the hardest skate they've had in professional hockey. And then the next night we beat the Boston Bruins, and I understand the Boston had nothing to play for, but we had no legs and half our team out of the lineup, and the next night we went in to beat Calgary. So those are the things that are the most important to me. The leaders got it done. So I ended up with a far higher opinion of our leadership through the difficulties than I did at first. And Bob, you're bang on. Like, I'm watching early on, and pucks are going in, the goalie's making saves, and life is great, and everybody just feels so darn good
because
it's not terrible here anymore. But you're standing behind the bench going, well, there is a level here. Because playing at this rate, we're 40 points better than the best team in hockey, and I'm pretty sure that's not the case. I know that it's not coming crashing down. I never felt that we got to a point, and I know people in Winnipeg may have, you know, kind of watching our team, so well, that's the team. It wasn't. We had a six-game stretch where we didn't win a game, but we got points out of those six games. Somebody asked me, one of the reporters asked me, what's the difference now when, you know, you're losing than when you were before? And I said, the simple answer is we're playing better now. And, of course, you know, they're not buying any of that. But the fact is we were playing a better quality of hockey. Early on, it was all energy and emotion and health. We had everybody in our lineup. After that, we had tremendous injuries, not a lot of energy, but the quality of our game, being able to understand what's going on in the ice. You know, sitting on the bench, knowing what's going on in the ice, that was so much better, and that's why I have a tremendous amount of hope for this team.
Paul, you coached in a non-traditional U.S. market. You coached in a big, big Canadian market. When you had a chance to kind of catch your breath and look around, what was it like coaching in Winnipeg? What's it like coaching in Winnipeg, which is obviously the smallest, the smallest city in the league, I think.
I'm gonna give you a pretty intense place, right? I'm going to give you a quote that's going to get me in a whole lot of trouble in Toronto. All right, so this is a gift to you guys.
Thank you very much.
And you have to expand the words out, but it's Toronto without all the BS. So there's all the passion and maybe then some for the game. It's not as big a city, but everybody is a Jets fan, right? It's their team. They brought the team back with the season ticket purchase. But there's not the same glamour to the hockey part of it. So there's not that whole kind of, I don't even know how to explain it in Toronto. It's just such a glamorous job, right? And there's so much media attention to it that you can't possibly love that part of it. Now, you can love coaching the Leafs and coming to the rink and being behind the bench, but at the end of the day, you can't love the notoriety of it there. Here in Winnipeg, you walk down the street, somebody says, well, and first of all, you don't walk down the street 6 months out of the year because it's too cold, but when you're walking kind of down the cause, people, hey, great job, loved the game last night, and off you go. Like, it's just really nice.
You can't hide, though, right? Yeah, there's nowhere, like, it's, even in Toronto, with as Leaf crazy it is, it's such a big place, you could find a place to hide.
Absolutely. There's more scrutiny there, it's more intense there, and when I was with the Leafs, Twitter wasn't Twitter. You know, there wasn't the instant, and so here's the example. I get the job. I'm fly from Columbus to Toronto, and I'm catching a plane to Winnipeg. And I'm sitting there, and kind of got a half a suit on, sort of. And there's two young girls that play ringette in Winnipeg, and I know it because it says on their shirt. And there's a TV over my head, and they're talking about Claude getting fired. And these kids don't know who I'm at, and they're on it. They're on the team. They're taking it apart. The coach, what they got to do next. Next thing you know, one of the other girls recognized me. So I'm getting my picture taken with the Winnipeg ringette team, right? Girls sit down. I call my wife and I say, you know, we're back in Canada. She goes, I know. You just had your picture taken with a girls ringette team.
Oh,
and I'm floored. Like, and it's happening while I'm there. You know, I'm on the phone with, I went through an elementary school that I think maybe you're in a high school that my boys will be going to maybe in Winnipeg. And I'm talking to my wife, asking her about some forms. And she says, yeah, well, I know you're there because it's on Twitter. Somebody at the school. So it's a completely different mindset now, but you're right. There's more scrutiny there, but there's none of the, and I don't like it. BS is not the right word, but it's a love hate in Toronto for the team.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a love and forgiveness part in Winnipeg. They're still so stinking happy that team's back there that they come to the building every night and they want to see you give them any reason to get out of the seats, and maybe that's the difference. Maybe I haven't processed anything better than that building is awesome. You know what I mean? The national anthem, they sing it, and you can hear them. And anything good happens, your fourth line goes out there and rattles around, and they're on their feet, and they're just truly enjoying the game. And maybe that's exactly been my take of why it's so good.
And the seats are full at the beginning of the period. You don't have to wait for people to show up.
there's no quiet strata there on Tuesday night after the first period is right.
Yeah.
Is right.
I can't believe Maurice blaming Brunt and I for making your life in Toronto miserable.
Did I do the media? Was it the media that part?
Well,
I think media in Winnipeg that they're not. No, it's not that. As a matter of fact, what's really unusual about that Toronto one is it's all the people around the team that I can't even explain it well.
But
playing for the Leafs, coaching the Leafs was a dream come true for me. The first year I loved, the second year I hated. It's just that it was almost like it was so big and so vast as a coach, you never felt like you were in control of it. Mm. Even when your team was playing good, you weren't controlling that spaceship. No, I'm not sure who is, but that thing was one or two losses from getting off the rails, and you weren't going to be able to.
You know, it has been suggested, Paul, that you know, whatever we want to call that thing that, you know, that creeps in with the Leafs, and certainly that when that creeps in with the players, it's one of the things that's made it hard to win in Toronto. That
yeah,
you know, it's that sense of, you know, not entitlement's the wrong word, but the kind of extraordinary celebrity you get win, lose, or draw in Toronto.
Right. There's a sense of protectionism that kicks in when the thought is that you might lose that job. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I found out with just people around the outside, it was like, oh my God, I could be out of here. I can't lose this job. It's the greatest job in the world. Maybe that's true. I don't know. I will tell you this. I think the day that the Leafs win, it's going to sneak up on them, right? They're going to be in a good year, having a good year, and no, they're not going to have the pressure of the whole year of being a contender, and then, boom, they're going to catch fire. The town will catch fire, and the next thing you know, there's a Stanley Cup there, and then 6 months after, they're going to want to know why it didn't happen every year. So it's still a wonderful, wonderful kind of tantalizing place to be a coach, because if you could hit one out of the park there, boy, it'd be a fun ride.
Prizes like no other, from a club like no other, the Fan Club. Log on to sportsnet590.ca.
Song has been done by a million artists.
Yes.
In a million bars. In a million towns. But there's only one Wilson Pickett version.
The Wicked Pickett.
Donna Marsh requested that, and there you go, Donna.
It's an eclectic selection tonight.
I want you to know, the idiot producers made the choices.
I still don't believe that with the one night in Bangkok.
We had hundreds. You can't pick them all. You know, you can't appease everybody. So we had to. What was the criteria that you used, or criterion that you used? If you had one, if you had it, we'd play it. Went through the record collection. Got him.
Next time, I'll help with the curatorial.
Go through the 45s.
I'm going to do the curatorial duties.
Have you ever seen a 45? Do you know what a 45 looks like? You do? Really? What's the little thing that the plastic thing that goes in the middle? Do you know what that is called? A spider? Is that it? Right?
I have no idea.
Me neither. Thought I'd ask. Try and trick him. It's not a spigot. It's a spider. Is that what they call it? Spider spindle. Yeah. Didn't you used to hate it when you used to stack up the 45s? Remember you used to stack them up? You had the bar thing in the middle with the hook thing, and then you'd put the spindle spigot thing in the middle of the 45s, then you'd pile them up and then they'd drop, right? One record would stop, and then next record would drop down, and you'd be sitting there waiting for the next record to come, and it wouldn't drop.
You realize this is like talking about like Thomas Edison wax cylinders at this
point. Yeah, I know. I hated when that happened.
Got rid of the wax cylinders?
All things that I can't, you know. I'd forgotten about all that stuff. What did you use if you didn't have one of those?
I don't know, Bob.
A spool of thread. Remember spools of thread?
I think those.
The wooden spool. Remember the wooden spool the thread used to be wrapped around? If you were handy, you could slide that onto the little stick thing. Just saying. 15 minutes before the hour.
Okay.
Do you want me to waste another 7 minutes?
No, we could stay in Pioneer Times if you want, but I could ask you something.
I'm an old cowhand.
So here's what I was going to ask you. I was thinking about this. The fixed fight thing was quite fascinating, and I still think there's a lot of intro. The fact that guy's actually saying this fight, by the way, this fight was fixed, and they paid off this judge, and he was in the business. Have you know? And we've had Declan.
But he wouldn't say how much. He said it wasn't as much as you.
Yeah, and that figures because
$50.
The judges are just folks, right? They're
just guys,
especially the mysterious ones. He's right about there was one of the judges in the first Lewis Holyfield fight was one of those mystery judges said he hasn't really judged a lot of fights. Who is this person? But you know, we've had Declan Hill in here a bunch, and he's you know made a pretty compelling case for the soccer games being fixed. Have you ever watched a sporting event where you thought it was fixed? You know, and I should have done this when Perkins was in here. Perkins was in here for it because, you know, Perky thinks he's a conspiracy theorist.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he thinks the Super Bowl's fixed.
Yeah, I'm a conspiracy theorist, too.
Perky thinks when the referees in the NFL go under the hood, they get secret orders from Roger Goodell.
Yeah.
Do you know, this is the way we got to call it because this is the way the betting's going. Like, and that's a great thing about Perk, but he does believe that stuff.
Yeah, but Perk.
I sat next to him in a million sporting events. He thought they were all fixed.
No, but Perk, here's the thing with Perk. And I don't like to talk to him about talk about him behind his back. He's probably listening right now.
I hope so.
So all you need to know about him is he likes to bet on sports.
Yes, he does. That's which so the fixing part would have direct implications for
him. I mean,
look,
I lived in Vegas. I used to sit at the Stardust Sportsbook every morning, 7 days a week, when the betting lines came out, and listen to degenerate sports bettors sitting there complaining about various things. And they were convinced that something untoward happened. Not necessarily a fix, but I mean, my favorite conversation was the two guys, and I swear to God this happened. It was the night after the Lakers played the Sacramento Kings. And the Lakers had Magic and Kareem and Worthy and Jabbar and, you know, I mean, they were great. And Sacramento had who, and who, right? So the Lakers are up like, I don't know, the spread's 17 points. Lakers are favorite. Lakers are up 30 with 6 minutes left. And Riley pulls, of course, pulls all the guys off the court and puts the scrubs in, right? Rambus and who actually was a decent player, but at that point was a scrub. And the Lakers win by 15. And guys would sit there and lament that Riley, he knew the number was 17. He did this on purpose. He screwed me. I had the minus 17. They won by 15. They're up by 30. And they'd be going on and on and on. I'm never betting the Lakers again. You can't trust Riley or the Lakers. 15 minutes later, the betting lines go up. Two guys are sitting there. They're making notes in their little book and whatever. One guy says to the other guy, and I'm telling you, this is a true story. One guy says to the other guy, he says, so who do you like? He says, well, I like the Lakers a bit.
And that's what keeps those the lights on in Las Vegas.
Well,
it's true. Degenerate gamblers.
Degenerate
God love them.
Gamblers, you know, they remember every bad beat they ever took, but they cannot remember those lucky wins that they had. You know, every game decided by a prayer at the buzzer or by a Hail Mary pass, they can remember the details right down to the nth. But when if they won those games, they will never mention it, never recollect it.
So, but back to you, because, you know, like I've been at fights where I thought something fishy happened. I was,
and the answer is
I've been at harness racing tracks out in a county fair where you knew the guys were all working with each other.
Oh, and now you got me.
Weird things happen.
Yeah, I got a boat race for you. Okay. I used to call them boat races. And it's a track. Yeah. So a horse named Exceptional Boy back in the 1970s. Dick Thornton used to play for the Toronto Argonauts. Thornton and I were roommates at the time, and we used to go to the track every once in a while. Paul Rimstead used to join us every now
Speaking
and again.
Of degenerate gamblers.
Yes. And what do I know? If I got to tell the story real fast. Anyway, Exceptional Boy had lost six races in a row. And we run into the owner or the trainer or somebody before the race. It gives us the wink, right? And off they go, and Exceptional Boy's in the middle of the track, and then all of a sudden he comes pounding around the turn. But he's not going to beat the horse that's in front of him. And I can't remember who the rider was. He's deceased now. Literally reins in the other horse. Stands on the brakes, you know? He's got a hold of this horse. He's pulling and yanking for all he's worth. Slow down, you pig! And he didn't get him to slow down enough. An Exceptional Boy lost by a nose in a photo.
That must have aroused some suspicion among the betting public.
Well, it aroused a lot of suspicion with us, but we didn't want to say anything because we had the tip that Exceptional Boy was going to win. And he didn't. So it was the fix that didn't fix.
Okay, so there's one.
This guy did everything but drag his feet on the track.